So good evening, everyone. You know, in case you're wondering if we practice what we preach, or at least if I do, I am sitting with a lot of feelings and sensations in my body right now that I often get when I do public speaking, especially in front of large groups. And it's amazing how the sensations change once you allow them. It's funny because the other night after La was sharing about laying that trip on themselves, that they should write a talk out, I was talking and sharing with the team that my teachers, most of my primary teachers, come from the Thai forest tradition, where it's not about writing a talk out. You know, the sort of highest ideal is to do what La did the other night, to just speak from the heart. So I lay a trip on myself about the fact that I write a talk out. So, you know, that just goes to show you, we will find whatever way we can to think that we're wrong. And I really think enlightenment is just really, you know, keeping the precepts and our commitment to the refuges, but then being who we are wherever we go. You know, really just allowing that. So, I'm going to talk tonight about ease and cultivating ease in our practice. And one of the most powerful statements about practice that I first heard from Joseph Goldstein, but I've heard since then a lot, and we've been kind of alluding to it as well, is this. He said, "It's not what's happening that matters, but our relationship to it." It's not what's happening that matters, but our relationship to what's happening. And it's almost embarrassing for me to admit how long it took me to really understand what that meant and to really apply it to my own life. And I think that awareness of what's happening and cultivating an easeful and open, allowing relationship to it is the key to our awakening. And so much of my practice has been about how to develop that sense of ease, that receptivity, that allowing, that acceptance, and how, when I do that, it helps me to experience more joy and freedom in my life. So when I'm practicing formally or even throughout the day, I'll drop those questions in. You know, what's happening right now? What's my relationship to this? And I'll do it again. And right now, what's happening? What's my relationship to this? Am I aware of my experience? And am I bringing a kind and caring attention to it? And to me, this is such an important inquiry because we often think freedom is a destination. You know, freedom is somewhere else in another moment, not this one. It's certainly not what's happening now that I don't like. It's some blissful state we once experienced, or it'll be when we no longer have all these challenging, judging thoughts, when we're not distracted, or when all the conditions around us are to our liking. Good luck with that, right? Awakening is not something we're going to get to. It's not a destination. It's always right here as a possibility. Something we're uncovering moment to moment. Not getting to somewhere else, but living into it right here. Thich Nhat Hanh said it this way, "There is no way to happiness. Happiness is the way. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. There is no way to enlightenment. Enlightenment is the way." And we make it a little hard on ourselves because we have to use language, because we're humans, and metaphors, and we talk about it in ways that turn it into a paradox. So we talk about a path and being on this path and moving along the path, and that's true. You know, we do choose a path and methods of practice and ways of developing spiritually, and we want to deepen and progress in our practice. We come on retreat so that we can deepen and hopefully leave the retreat with some more inspiration to continue what we've nurtured here. We don't always want to be at the beginning, starting again. We don't want to journey and just hop around from one method to another. There is a sense of progression. There is a sense of a path that we're following. We don't want to do what I did for years, which is come running to practice when things are going wrong and then sort of get lax and let the practice fall off when things are seemingly going better again. Does anyone identify with that? But it's one of the central paradoxes, and there are lots of paradoxes, people. We're on a path, but there's nowhere to go. Another paradox is the transformation that we seek comes from acceptance. And I'm sure you're sick of us talking about acceptance and allowing. Pat's right, we talk about acceptance all the time as if we can just make it happen. But it's really friggin' hard to do. It requires lots of training and cultivation to simply let go. And so that's why we're here, committing to this. It's not easy, it needs effort and diligence. A lot of patience showing up over and over and over, moment to moment. On the cushion, in walking practice, movement practice, standing in line, eating, going to the bathroom, noticing all the transitions. Just over and over again, bringing our awareness to our hearts and our bodies and our minds. Experimenting with what works and what doesn't. If sitting is not working, trying standing if we're sleepy or if that helps to alleviate some pain. Giving effort to different techniques, different postures, testing it out, and trying again if something is not working. It's really boring. And it's annoying. But then we have these moments, you know, sometimes they're just micro moments of being able to connect to some happiness and peace. And we get tastes of that joy and freedom. And the challenge is not to just kind of speed over those and not gloss over them or obsess over them after the fact. But really experience and savor them. Not take them for granted while they're happening. Whether it's the easeful sensation of just one breath, or the taste of one sip of tea. Those little moments are like little crumbs or clues. You know, glimpses of what's really possible if we can just open up to it. And we're in such a great environment for it, right? You know, the weather has been beautiful, the sky has been amazing, we have goats. It said, awakening is an accident and practice makes you accident prone. And even though it's hard and boring and annoying, many of us keep doing it. We've been doing it for years because ultimately it works to some extent. Bit by bit, it starts to work its magic on us. So I want to share a little bit of my story with some of this process of the pathless path. So I started seriously practicing and studying these teachings 20 years ago, when I stopped just reading about formal meditation and actually tried my first 10-day retreat and started working formally with a teacher. And back then, I didn't even know what was happening, let alone have a really good relationship to it. When Jonathan was talking about that circle this morning and what was conscious and unconscious, when I was thinking about me back then, it was like, I don't know, if you were standing back far enough, you wouldn't even know there was a line. Because I was like... And I was definitely trying to get somewhere else, like not be in the experience I was in, because I was in so much pain and dis-ease. Just like, I feel like it was on a constant basis, you know. I was in my late 20s then, and living in New York City, partying a lot. I used all sorts of things, everything under the sun, to try and get away from my experience. Drugs, sex, alcohol, entertainment, work, going back to school, studying hard, not studying, just whatever distractions I could find. And they didn't work. I think I was known as what's called a hot mess. I was really anxious and really emotional, like overly emotional a lot. I used to drive my friends crazy. But like La described earlier, I was really comfortable with those patterns because they were familiar. And even if I was miserable, that's what I knew. I learned how to be like that growing up. You know, that was kind of the modeling I had. And in some ways, I really clung to my pain because it was familiar. You know, I think back on it now and I feel so much empathy for that poor young person. I remember I used to like conjure up, fantasize, I don't know, just pull up these emotions almost so that I could feel a pain in my chest. Like, it wasn't a good feeling, but somehow, like, I got some, I wouldn't call it a sick comfort, but there was something about it that was familiar. It was like, at least I was feeling. It's kind of like what Pat was talking about with the action movies last night. You know, they're just so intense because people want to feel. And so we kind of ricochet between these intense feelings and then numbing out and back and forth, and we just don't know how to regulate somewhere in the middle. So although I was in therapy at the time, I really hadn't yet processed like all the trauma from my childhood. I was working in social justice work in low-income Black and Latino communities, and I had a lot of confusion and rage about race and injustice, and that was taking a big toll on me as well, energetically. I had a lot of good friends, which was important, I think. That's one of the reasons why I didn't completely fall apart. But I had a lot of difficulty in relationship, especially romantic relationships. But by some karmic good fortune, I had come to the Dharma actually before that academically in college. And so I was sort of slowly making my way to the practice itself. And some thing gave me the wherewithal to actually start practicing and to seek out a teacher. So I started in a Zen tradition at that time, and my teacher, Barry, he used to have his Zendo in his psychotherapy office in the West Village. And the meetings were at 10 a.m. on Saturday mornings. So as you can imagine, 10 a.m. on Saturday morning is not a good time for a party girl. So even if I was completely destroyed from the night before, I would still try and get to practice. So I had to make it from Brooklyn to the West Village. But Barry would lock the door to his office exactly at 10 a.m., like an annoying Zen person would do. And I can't tell you how many times I was like racing from the elevator down the hallway, and I would hear the lock. And I went to do this like Buddhist walk of shame back to the subway. I was like a terrible student. But Barry just kept meeting my complete messiness with just a lot of kindness and compassion. And I slowly just started to learn to sit. I had no idea what I was doing, but I just knew that there was something good there for me. And, you know, it's Zen, so there wasn't much instruction, another annoying Zen thing. But I would just sit, you know. And I was the youngest person in the room by far. I think I was 27 when I started there. And I was the only person of color. And if I didn't feel like I fit in the rest of the world and felt awkward, I really did not fit in there. I probably, like, reeked of booze, you know, I don't know. Like, I don't know what they made of me. I'm still friends with Barry, so that's a good thing. But I really didn't connect with other people beyond a superficial level besides him. But something kept me going back, and I was reading, his teacher was Charlotte Joko Beck, and I was reading everything by her and by other teachers, and, you know, slowly arriving more and more in my seat. So the Sangha was quite small back then. It's grown a lot now and moved somewhere else, but it was only about 10 of us usually. And no one moved at all. Like, they were like super still. So it was like just a bunch of old white people like on cushions facing the wall because it was Zen, right? And I was allergic to something in the room, and so my nose would start running, and I was like, oh, I don't want to move. So I would like really sneakily move a tissue up to my nose. But at some point in Dakusan, the weekly meetings with the teacher, when I would make the weekly meetings, you know, I talked to Barry about it, and I said, you know, my nose is running, and I don't know what to do. And, you know, Zen meetings are just ridiculous, because you just come in, and he's just like, nothing. Like, the first time I went in, I was just like, what is going on? He doesn't say anything. And I'm just sitting there, and, you know, really have to just be with all the feelings. He's not going to try and make me feel comfortable. So, you know, this is later on, I understand the deal now, and I share with him that, you know, my nose is running, and I don't know what to do. And he just says, well, what's wrong with your nose running? And I was just like, oh, I don't have, like, some witty Zen response to that. So I went back to my seat, and I let my nose run. And, you know, it wasn't pretty. But I just sat with it. And it was okay. And it was a really profound experience. You know, every week I would just come and, you know, sometimes it would stop and sometimes it wouldn't. And I just want to say I'm not telling you not to blow your noses. But it didn't change all that much in my life. You know, I have to be honest there. I was still a mess. I still had terrible relationships and a lot of emotional upheavals in my life. And I went and still did a lot of therapy. But there was something in that just being with it, just knowing the experience and allowing it, that was my first real lesson of what does that mean? You know, it's not what's happening that's the important part. It's our relationship to it. Can we just allow and accept our experience? And I have really vivid, visceral memories of that, like of what that felt like. You know, we don't have much, if any, control over what happens internally and especially externally. We can't control what's going to arise in the next session or how our backs will feel or if we're coughing or sneezing or what thoughts come up. it's not like we choose to have self-loathing thoughts, you know. It's not like, so next session, I want to get a lot of shame and upset about that really tiny mistake I made at work last week. It just happens, you know. It's our patterning. And we can't control other people, obviously, even though I've tried to control my husband for years. But we can learn to meet whatever is happening with kindness and care. As Pat said, we have these evolutionary tendencies, these so-called hindrances, and those are not going away. They haven't gone away for me. I'm assuming they haven't gone away for my friends over here. But our relationship to them changes. Someone in meeting today was sharing that she really, after Pat's talk, is trying to change her relationship to these hindrances and really befriend them, to see them as allies, you know, that are in some way, yes, trying to protect her. You know, a diluted understanding of what will free us, but you know, can we befriend these tendencies? Can doubt become discernment? And we can see the patience and the faith that's required for us to develop that possibility. Because inevitably, all the annoyances will throw us off. The temperature fluctuations, the body aches, the sounds we don't like, the itchiness, the fidgeting, the worries, the obsessions, the fantasies. They arise and it feels like everything has just turned over again. And we start again. And that's why I love retreat so much. Because it's this opportunity for a really simplified, pared down way to practice. Because if we can't be with our own breath, how are we going to be with the bigger challenges in life? And so as boring as it is, as annoying as it is, we keep coming back. And that determination, that effort is why we're here together, to support each other in being able to do that. I like the metaphor of the anchor that we've been using, also because visually, you know, an anchor drops and is able to help a boat, you know, stay secure no matter what the waves are like. And when I think of it in my life, you know, practice allows me to be able to drop that anchor in a moment's notice. Without practice, I'm like trying to find the anchor. Is it in the front of the boat? Is it the back of the boat? It's tied up. It's tangled in things. So even if I know the mechanism of what's required, I don't have the facility or the quickness. Or it's like learning to ride a bike. You know, when a kid first learns to ride a bike, it's like, whoa. But even when we're riding, it's not that we're completely balanced. We're making these micro adjustments, even after we ride for years. And in this way, we're learning how to be free. Regardless what's happening around us, we can drop that anchor, and even if the sea is really tumultuous, we feel secure. Sometimes I like to, you know, look for role models or examples of what freedom looks like to me, and a lot of the people I see in my own life and also see in the larger culture is free really have a lot of joy. You know, I think of people like some of my teachers, but also people like the Dalai Lama and Nelson Mandela or Desmond Tutu, people who face great adversity but still have this buoyancy and this lightness about them. Speaking of Joseph Goldstein, I used to be the executive director of New York Insight, and when Joseph wrote Mindfulness, which I remembered this because we were talking about this book today, you know, he spent, I don't know how long, working on this book. It's an incredible book. If you don't know it, it's beautiful. And so it came out, I don't know, some years ago, and he decided to have a book party through New York Insight. And so we rented a big venue. Hundreds of people were coming. And we ordered the books beforehand to arrive at the venue the day before, the day of the event. And there was a huge snowstorm. And his books didn't come. And I was the one that had to tell him when he walked in. And I was really worried about it, and I was talking to one of his good friends, and I was like, Joseph's books didn't come. And she said, oh, don't worry, Joseph is one of the most spacious people I know. And so I went up to him, and I said, you know, Joseph, I'm sorry, I have some bad news, your books didn't arrive. You know, there are hundreds of people coming for this book launch. And it was so interesting to see his face just kind of, like, there was disappointment. You know, there was some upset, but it was gone. And there was no projecting of that on me. There was no kind of trying to micromanage. Everyone else was trying to micromanage. Maybe we should run to the bookstore and get some blank papers and he can sign those and people can paste them in the books when they get them later. Like, all this trying to, like, manage the situation. But he had such a sense of spaciousness about it and lightness and, you know, immediately went to just a sense of joy, just a sense of enjoying the situation that we were in. So that's just a small example, but it's important for me to see what freedom looks like. You know, what is this? So Charlotte Joko Beck said this. The difficulties in practice are there. If we don't recognize them and why they arise, we tend to fool ourselves. Still, the ultimate reality, not only in our sitting, but also in our lives, is joy. By joy, I don't mean happiness. They're not the same. Happiness has an opposite. Joy does not. As long as we seek happiness, we're going to have unhappiness. Because we're always swinging from one pole to the other. Joy is who we are if we're not preoccupied with something else. Joy is exactly what is happening, minus our opinion of it. Joy is exactly what is happening, minus our opinion of it. So we talk about dukkha, what's often translated as suffering, and then freedom from suffering. And the Buddha talked about dukkha in different ways. So he talked about dukkha-dukkha, which is the physical and mental suffering that's inevitable in life. Pain, aging, sickness, death, loss. None of us are getting out of that. You know, that's part of the human experience. That's part of the deal. But what he was teaching us is that there are other types of dukkha, and that this kind of dukkha is optional. It's the second arrow we've been talking about. It's the anxiety or stress to try to hold on to things that are inherently impermanent and constantly changing. It's the basic anxiety and lack of satisfaction that we have with this conditioned reality. The reality is that there is pain things are impermanent, everything is conditioned and subject to karma or patterning, cause and effect. But we're constantly trying to hold on to the good experiences and push away the bad ones. And we want things different from what they are. And that's why we suffer. And even our practice becomes subtle or not so subtle examples of this. You know, being with the back pain so that it'll go away. We don't want things as they are, so we have this type of clinging that becomes resistance. And there's that equation, pain times resistance equals suffering. And that's the dukkha, that's the suffering we can find freedom from, is working on that resistance and cultivating a sense of allowing also to the pain, which is natural. So in Pali, the language we've been referring to, these early teachings, dukkha itself is a metaphor etymologically. So the prefix du means bad, and ka has the root of axle wheel, axle hole of a wheel. So sukha, which Pat mentioned last night, is often translated as happiness, but it's that deep contentment he was describing. The prefix su is good. So we have good axle hole and bad axle hole. And I think it's such a brilliant metaphor, right, for our practice. The way I like to think of it is that it doesn't matter how the road is. If my axle hole is crooked or off, I'm going to have a bumpy ride. So I could have the smoothest road. I could have people cooking for me, have no responsibilities, be in nature, have goats. And I could be having a really bumpy ride. And I like this way of looking at it too, because it acknowledges the external realities that sometimes we have a bumpy road. So we can work on our axle hole. You know, we can continue to smooth it, learn to accept, learn to slow down when we get to the bumps. What happens when, even if you have a great axle hole, if you hit a bumpy road and you're speeding, you're going to really feel those bumps. So learning to slow down when things are difficult. It also helps us acknowledge that different people have different roads. And whole communities have shitty roads. So this smoothing of the axle, of recognizing the road we're on, maybe getting off the road sometimes, taking a break, trying a different route for a moment if it's possible, helping each other along the road, helping fix other people's roads. We can go really far with these metaphors. So I think about this practice as one of smoothing this axle hole or truing the wheel for those of you who are cyclists. Developing this more easeful way of riding this experience of life. And this has been true for me. So I've come a long way since my snotty Zen meditations and done a lot of practice over the years, and it's really served me well. And I've had a lot of challenges. So I've shared with some of you in meetings that I'm a 3-time cancer survivor. I was diagnosed 3 times within the space of 10 years. And 2 years ago, I was re-diagnosed the third time with stage 4 metastatic breast cancer. And for those of you who are lucky enough to know nothing about cancer, there's no stage 5. So I went through, I've been through many treatments and surgeries and protocols, and 2 years ago, I was really lucky to be very supported by a lot of friends, including La and Tara and others, and able to take time off and really take care of myself, do a lot of long retreat practice, do alternative care and conventional care. And about a year ago, I got clear scans, which was great, and really felt like a miracle. Cancer was really all over. And a month after I got my clear scans, on my birthday, my mom fell, had a stroke and a heart attack. She lived in Ethiopia, so I had to fly to Ethiopia, deal with third world nonsense for a week, which was just nuts, get her out of Ethiopia to London, spend 2 weeks with her in London, and she passed away there. Very suddenly, it was a shock to all of us. My older sister, who's intellectually disabled, came to live with me and my husband, so we became her full-time caretakers. I got hit by a car. I got pneumonia. It's just been nuts. And I'm not going to say it's easy and that the practice is magic, and I didn't have other support systems like lots of therapy. But it's incredible how much I was still able to anchor and to connect to a sense of ease and also perspective and joy. My practice, I don't know what people do who don't have a practice, because my practice is such an incredible support. And I don't mean this practice. You know, I don't think the Buddha Dharma is the only practice, but some practice to help ground them for the inevitable rough waters that will come. So I was actually with La a couple of weeks after I got diagnosed 2 years ago. We were at our CDL4, our community Dharma leader, that was our training program. We were at a reunion for a number of us who met. And even though it was so soon after my diagnosis and I was still probably in some shock, I knew it would be good for me to be in that supportive environment. One of my main teachers was there. And La and I would room together as usual, because La snores and I can't wake up for anything. So like perfect roommates. And, you know, it was really sweet. Like, we shared, and there was a lot of crying and tears and sharing about my fears and not knowing what was going to happen. And there were also a lot of laughs. The reunion had been planned months before, and I don't know, someone psychically... We create it so that we also learn from each other. And so someone had psychically created a death panel, like a panel to talk about death. So I was talking to La, and I was like, oh, my God, they're going to ask me to be on the death panel, aren't they? And La was like, don't worry, you don't have to say anything. We'll just be like Exhibit A. Which is like such a morbid joke, but it's so funny, right? And it's just so important to be able to connect to that, you know? We're all gonna die. They say this practice is preparing us for death. But can we be with this experience right now? being with my mom as she was dying was so profound. If any of you have witnessed, and I know many of you, a number of you have said that you work in hospice care, such a profound experience and an opportunity to touch into all of these emotions that are within us and possible, fear and pain and joy and connection and I miss her a lot. I'm wearing her shirt today. But I also allow myself not only to grieve, which I still am doing. It hasn't been a year yet, and I've been so caught up in taking care of my sister and all else that's going on that, you know, the grief is still right there sometimes. But I also just have so many wonderful memories and allow myself to feel that too. So I want to, before and I want to say a few more things, and I want to just touch on these very bumpy times we're in. So the road is really rough for a lot of people and for the planet. And I really believe, you know, we sort of started the retreat this way, but I really believe what we're doing here is so important, taking this time to really smooth our own axle holes, to prepare ourselves to really be better stewards of our planet and each other. And I know there are many people who are activists and healers and frontline workers here. And it's just so important that you continue to care for yourself. It's really revolutionary to move through the world in a different way. I like this quote these days by Albert Camus, who said, "The only way to deal with an unfree world is to become so absolutely free that your very existence is an act of rebellion. The only way to deal with an unfree world is to become so absolutely free that your very existence is an act of rebellion." And this from Patrice Cullors, one of the founders of Black Lives Matter. She described the movement's mission as one to provide hope and inspiration for collective action, to build collective power to achieve collective transformation. It's rooted in grief and rage, but pointed toward vision and dreams. I just want to end by offering three things besides formal practice that have been really important supports for me. So I think we mentioned that sati, the word that we miserably translated as mindfulness, really has this connotation of presence and awareness and also of remembering. That's one of its roots etymologically. So it's about remembering in moment to moment, but it's also remembering the truth of our incarnation, you know, that there is pain, there is this human condition. It's not a mistake if we get sick. You know, sometimes when I was first diagnosed, I noticed this tendency to be like, why me? I was 34 when I was first diagnosed. You know, why me? And then I started asking myself, why not me? You know, this happens. People get sick. People die. So one thing that really supports me in remembering that is the 5 daily recollections, which some of you might be familiar with. So, you know, the chants that we don't do as much in sort of the Western Dharma are just full of wisdom. So this is one of the daily chants along with the refuges and the precepts. And these are the 5 recollections. I am of the nature to grow old. I cannot avoid aging. I am subject to illness and infirmity. I cannot avoid illness and infirmity. I am of the nature to die. I cannot avoid death. I will be parted from all that is dear and beloved to me. I am the owner of my actions and heir to my actions. The fruits of all my actions, both wholesome and unwholesome, skillful and unskillful, I will inherit. So I used to read those every morning for a long time when I first got sick, just as a reminder, you know, to remember that this is the human reality. There is pain, there is suffering, there is illness, there's death, there's loss, and there's karma. And this isn't depressing. You know, it's not to bum ourselves out, but it's to really be realistic about what's here and allowing that reality to open us up to the moment, to that freedom and joy that's always right there. So the second thing that has really been important to me is the earth herself. You know, really having a connection to nature, which is not easy in Brooklyn. It's something I've been doing recently whenever I travel, especially when I'm teaching retreats in different places. I find out who the indigenous peoples were of that land. So the Piscataway people and their ancestors date back 12,000 years to Baltimore County area in this part of Maryland. So they were here for centuries before colonization, stewarding this land. And I've been so touched by the way this land is being stewarded now, and just thankful for all those centuries that it was stewarded. Because I really believe that separation from the land is one of the core wounds of our suffering and our misery. And we were all indigenous to some place at some point. And even if we don't know to where, we have even recent ancestors who are more connected to the land than us. And having some feeling of that has been really important for me in terms of having a perspective. And the last thing that has been really important for me in this remembering is the great mystery that Pat touched on last night. That's really the source of it all. You know, it's the source of creativity. It's the source of life. Einstein said, "The most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious, and if we can no longer pause to wonder and stand wrapped in awe, we're as good as dead." And I find this practice really brings me in touch with that. You know, shakes me out of my slumber of or overactivity, my dream and haze, to just witness a leaf falling. you know, or a kitten. I was watching this little kitten come out from the bushes before. And of course, nature is a great teacher of that, but we are nature. Our own bodies are incredibly mysterious. And if we know anything about it scientifically, I mean, we're more space than matter. Time is an illusion. There are up to 11 or more dimensions. I don't even know what that means. There's so much we don't understand. We know scientifically that the great sages and saints and shamans and witches are right. You know, we're interconnected. There's really no separation. And so can our practice be about that too, really resting in that mystery and wonder. I think that's as good a place as any to end. So I'd love if we could sit for a few moments together. This is a poem by Joy Harjo of the Muscogee Nation. It's called Remember. Remember the sky that you were born under. Know each of the stars' stories. Remember the moon. Know who she is. I met her in a bar once in Iowa City. Remember the sun's birth at dawn. That is the strongest point of time. Remember sundown and the giving away tonight. Remember your birth, how your mother struggled to give you form and breath. You are evidence of her life and her mother's and hers. Remember your father. He is your life also. Remember the earth whose skin you are. Red earth, black earth, yellow earth, white earth, brown earth, we are earth. Remember the plants, trees, animal life, who all have their tribes, their families, their histories too. Talk to them, listen to them. They are alive poems. Remember the wind, remember her voice. She knows the origin of this universe. I heard her singing Kiowa war dance songs at the corner of 4th and Central once. Remember that you are all people and that all people are you. Remember that you are this universe and that this universe is you. Remember that all is in motion, is growing, is you. Remember that language comes from this. Remember the dance that language is, that life is. Remember.